Hello, and welcome to Choral Connectivity, a people-first approach to singing, Season 2. Through this podcast, we explore the meaningful ways that teaching singing can affect human nature, discuss teaching philosophies, and celebrate amazing stories of people who are doing incredible and meaningful work in the choral field. I'm your host, Kirsten Oberoi, and I'm here to help inspire you. You, the teacher, you, the singer, you, the educator, you, the conductor, whoever you are, these weekly episodes will help you remember that each voice is totally unique. And more importantly, the story behind each person who is singing with you is incredibly valuable and important to this world. Before we dive in with open arms and hearts to today's episode, I want to remind you that you can always reach me on the Choral Connectivity Facebook page or website. Let's see how we can change the face of choral music just a little bit more today. Hello, everybody, and happy springtime. The weather is changing, the sun is shining for longer, and it just brings so much joy into my soul. I am so excited to present today's guest for us today. I recorded this a couple of weeks ago with Adrian Dunn, who is doing some incredible work lifting up and empowering Black music and Black musicians. He is a composer and a conductor and a performer and just really speaks his own truth. And he speaks from his heart and writes from his heart. And I couldn't be more excited for you to hear what he has to say today. Definitely, after you're done, head on over to YouTube or his website, click on the PBS link special to the live performance of Emancipation Act 2, or go check it out wherever you listen to music, Spotify, Apple Music, it's there. Definitely have a listen. He's doing some interesting and incredible work. And so listen about it and then go listen to it. Super, super great. And I just hope you're all having a really great season. I know this season can get tight, and if you're teaching, maybe you're doing a musical, or you're going to festival, or you're going to be adjudicated. And I can't think of a better time to remind you that what you get, this grade you get at festival, doesn't matter. The people who are in front of you are the ones who matter. Make sure to remind them of that, and make sure to remind yourself of that as you go into this season. But without further ado, here we go, my conversation with Adrian. Enjoy. My friends, I am here today with Adrian Dunn, a composer and singer and conductor and just a magical human. And I'm so excited to introduce him to you today and his story. Welcome to the show, Adrian.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So rather than me introducing you, why don't you go ahead and just give us a little bit about your background, your story, how you came to music, and what you're up to now?
Absolutely. So I came to music as a child. I grew up in a small Black Baptist church in Cleveland, Ohio, learning primarily gospel music and the music of the church. And my dad was not a musician, but was a deacon in the church. My mom sang and went to an HBCU in North Carolina, Elizabeth City State, where she was a part of the college choir and the concert choir, did a lot of touring and things like that. And my mom really supported me a lot through my journey, particularly my early music journey. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. I went to Cleveland Heights High School and high schools, elementary school, middle school. Then in high school, I went to Interlochen, and I was a part of the Cleveland Orchestra Youth Chorus Organization, Ohio All-State Choir, did all of the things, and got a scholarship to college at Roosevelt University, where I majored in voice. Chicago kind of made me, you know, as a professional. My first professional jobs with the Chicago Symphony Chorus, the Grand Park Symphony Chorus, and other chorus master work. Throughout the city with Chicago Opera Theater, as well as I've worked with Lyric Opera, I've worked with the South Shore Opera Company on some really cool and exciting projects. And all of those things really led me to, in my adult career, working on opera, a hip hop opera at 19 or 20 years old, which was combining hip hop and opera, the two things that I loved the most at that time, and telling stories about eight of my classmates in high school that lost their lives, actually. And through the medium of opera, making sure that we preserve their lives and their stories. And that gave me the strength to continue as an entrepreneur, and continuing the work that I was doing on my own terms about creating a space for Black music in America. And my advocacy organization, Black Music Matters. And that really surrounds this entire topic about Black music in America and me kind of raising this prospect that Black music needs our attention, and needs to be something that is worthy of preservation in the larger conversation of American music, particularly in vocal and choral music, in ways that we don't often frame the conversation. With that, I started the Adrian Dunn Singers. We're an all-Black professional vocal ensemble in the city of Chicago, as well as my all-Black professional orchestra, the Rise Orchestra. We are working on our fourth commercial album right now that just came out in Emancipation, which are all spiritual arrangements and/or gospel original compositions by me that are inspired by Black 20th and 21st century thought leaders that have shaped my life. This is a part of a trilogy cycle. The first installment is Redemption, which are spirituals and gospel songs dedicated to Black men and women murdered by police.
Wow. There is so much that I want to ask you about that. What an incredible story and what incredible work you are doing to lift up these voices in a way that, they should be lifted up and we should be paying attention to. And I have great hope that more and more are.
Absolutely.
And I think that's really beautiful. So let's back up a little bit. And I wrote down a couple of questions as you were talking. The first is hip hop and opera.
Yes.
Can you talk to us just a little bit more about your project there? And because I know I've never come across something like that. And that is so fascinating sounding, and especially how you lifted up those stories of those friends that you had that lost their lives. Can you tell us a little bit more about that project and what that's like?
Sure. So Hopra, when I was in undergraduate, I started producing a piece called Hopra. And it was really a way for me to preserve these stories of my high school classmates that had lost their lives. But it was more than that. It was my first major entrepreneurial project. I raised all the funds, I did all of the things to get it on its feet. And as a part of that process, I also received a MacArthur grant that helped me start my company and fund the work of Hopra in the early thousands. And so Hopra has a really special place in my heart that way, as it really was the piece that allowed me to see myself not only as a singer, but as a composer. And as a composer that I felt was worthy of support, and as a composer in a way that it was like, oh wow, people will pay to come and hear what I've written. And to this point in my life, I had, I've been a voice major and all of my teachers were voice teachers, et cetera. So I hadn't really had the confidence as a composer, I think, to really kind of step out that way. So Opera came out in its premiere in 08, and we did a Chicago premiere in 2009. It's about a hour and 45 minute work with intermission, and yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
And so unique and really I love when people go out of the way and they say, all right, I have an idea and I haven't really seen this before, but I'm gonna do it anyway. And that's so inspiring and such a cool story. I can relate very much to it because similarly, that's how I started my organization, which is a children's choir. But doing it a little bit differently, But similar to you, I can kind of always had seen myself as, okay, I'm a musician. I'm a teacher. My degree's in composing. Like I'm do the music side. But then all of a sudden, when you get a real project that you're passionate about, all of a sudden this entrepreneur just sort of like hops out at you and you're like, all right, if I'm going to do this idea, I got to figure out how to pay for it. So I guess that's going to be me or me. So it's going to be me.
Right. Exactly. I get that for sure. Yeah.
And you know, you just jump in with 2 feet and the amazing things that can come out of that are really, really neat. And then, so you also talked about Black Music Matters. And this is an organization that you founded.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the kind of work that you're doing there.
Yeah, so Black Music Matters is just an organization that is really trying to highlight the contributions of Black composers, artists, and musicians, and really highlight what has traditionally been disparities in the music industry as it relates to Black artists. And so I think what I'm really striving to do is to make sure that people understand that, you know, these disparities, one, still exist, two, oftentimes have never really been talked about, particularly as it relates to formal education for those of us who went to college or went to, you know, went into academia in whatever way. Oftentimes, these are not conversations that we talk about. And often, more often than not, this is a part of American music history that is just not taught. Just in general. So I think why it's so important, you know, similar to the 1619 Project and some of the other projects that have gained traction over the past, you know, 5-6 years. I think it's so important that we have conversations as musicians, as educators, as composers about the role of Black music in it. And what I often say in all of our touring performances, this idea that Black folks are indeed the true authors of American music.
That's so true. And it's so, so important for us to pass that message on, because there is so much of our history that I know I probably learned more after going to school, at doing my own research and talking to folks like you and, you know, doing my own reading and doing my own research. But really there is just so much, and, you know, America is built on, as we said, like this great melting pot, and our history is our history as all of the people in it, and giving so much worth to the creators of these sounds and music that then later formed into pop and you know, everything that we listen to now. It's really, really important. So it's great that you're doing that work. And then also lifting up other Black artists in the Adrian Dunsingers and The Rise. I know I went and listened to a couple of your YouTube videos, and I mean, what incredible sounds your groups make. I mean, it is just, it's so moving and so lovely to see. What kind of response have you gotten from maybe audiences about bringing all Black orchestra and all Black chorus up in front of them? You know, what have you found that jars audiences in a new way?
Well, I think it's always been a beautiful process, because anytime as a composer that anyone is doing your music and listening to your music is a privilege. So I would start there. But two, I think that one huge thing about what I do is I'm always talking about the people whose shoulders I stand on, as if I am one in a line of great folks that have come before me and that have been doing this for quite literally what feels like in my lifetime forever. And I often lift up the voices of Moses Hogan. I lift up the voices of Roland Carter and Nathan Carter. I lift up people like Dr. David Morrow at Morehouse and Wendell Whalum at Morehouse. The Rosephany Powells. I lift up people like Margaret Bonds. I lift up people like Florence Price. I could go on and on and on. And my point here about how this relates to the historical piece is that if we all learned the honest truth about who was writing these pieces at the turn of the 20th century and the 19th century, all of these things, I feel like we would be in a different place. So when people see the Adrian Dunn Singers and Rise Orchestra and some of these pieces, they might sound familiar to them, or they might know, you know, some of the texts associated with some of the arrangements. I think people are often taken by, one, just the pure craftsmanship of what it is that we do. We do all original compositions that are inspired by Black folks that have gone on oftentimes and continuing to proclaim this truth. So I feel like when people see the show, they're automatically kind of like, wow, one of two responses. One is, I've never heard anything like this before. Because depending on geographically where you grew up in the United States, you may not have ever come in contact with, unfortunately,
right,
this music in this form, right? Mm-hmm. So in America, we've heard it in pop. We hear it represented in every genre, right? But not in this kind of choral concert, spiritual orchestral performance, if you will, concert hall, theater, et cetera. And so that's great. But, you know, all of the reactions generally are, wow, wow, you know, so I'm really grateful for the work that we do.
I couldn't agree more. I watched the videos and thought, wow. And my first, honestly, my first instinct in watching it was saying, wow, each of these performers is so independently a master of their craft.
Mm-hmm.
It was just beautiful watching, you know, it wasn't a very large group, but yeah, the sound individually that every player and every singer was creating was just so ingrained in them and their souls. It was really, really quite moving. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Emancipation and this project? It's so unique and wonderful, and I can't wait to share with my listeners a little bit about it.
Yeah. So as I say in the foreword of Emancipation, Emancipation is the story of my life in so many words. They are the Black 20th and 21st century thought leaders that have shaped my life as a Black queer man in America. And I think that it's so important to raise up these voices because so many people don't know who they are. Mm. So for example, Jericho is really inspired by the quote of a Black woman, Audre Lorde, and the quote says that if I didn't define myself for myself, I would be crushed into other people's realities for me and eaten alive. Jericho is really about what it is to wake up in America every day as a Black queer man and to fight for your life. And so Jericho in the dramatic, and what I think of my choral writing as being somewhat operatic, actually, and extremely dramatic, and also in the style that the singers are singing in, you know, I think is leans more opera than it leans what we would traditionally think of as choral singing, if you will.
Sure.
And for this reason, because these stories have such a sense of heightened dramaticism. They have so much in them. The stakes are so high, right? That I feel like you have to sing them that way. There is no other way to sing them. You know, Glory, Zeke, loosely based off of Ezekiel Saw the Wheel and William Dawson and telling that story. The Black Boy Prayer, talking about the prayers that I prayed as a young child not to be gay, you know, and to really also open up the conversation of what it is to be Black and queer and a man in America and those unique challenges. And oftentimes those are messages and things that I don't hear in choral music. At least I've been singing choral music my whole life and I've never sang a piece. Even in my entire undergraduate, graduate education, I never had a Black voice teacher. Even in high school, middle school, I never had a Black choral teacher, right? And so raising all of these things to say that all of this together for me is the story of my own emancipation, musically, artistically. I pose that question, what does it mean to be Black and free in the 21st century? In emancipation, this album really seeks to answer that question through all of these musical genres created by Black Americans.
So the album itself is in two acts, correct?
Yes.
And
yes.
And both acts are now out?
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. And yes. And we were chatting a little bit earlier, and the first act is more based in gospel and rock, and the second act maybe a little bit more choral focused.
Yeah, so the first act is jazz, gospel, yes. And some hip hop with Freedom. And then the act two is the orchestral overture, as well as some of the a cappella choral pieces and some of the choral orchestral combined pieces and Black Boy Prayer.
So your theme that ties this all together, it's very thematic, but it combines all these different genres. And I think that's so unique. And I think that's such a beautiful message as well. Bringing all of the influences of Black music in America through your piece. What an incredible, just what an incredible story. And so personal to you. So what does it feel like then to have singers singing these words and performing this music that is, I mean, really, truly a very personal story of you and your experiences? That must be a very vulnerable place for you.
Yeah. And I think I grew up in classical music where when I was young, I was told that music has no color. Music has no nationality. It has no. That was the generation I grew up in, right? And I've come to know that as an adult and now as a music educator and being in these positions now as an educator, that I believe, my personal belief is that that is absolutely wrong. Mm. And I believe so firmly in it that I believe that so much of the music that I learned as a child could have been even more powerful for me in my experience had adults or teachers really, really delved into the cultural context, the personal context, the emotional context, you know, all of the things, not just the good stuff that makes us feel good as singers, right? But let's get to the truth. And I think that if choral music is going to live on in America for generations to come, we have to begin to, one, continue to speak truth to power. Two, we have to be willing to show up and show ourselves. We have to be able to show who we really are in the music. And that is what reaches other people. What reaches other people is the honesty and I think the rawness that shows up in my music and in these stories. I'm not the only Black queer kid that prayed to God not to be gay. I'm not the only kid, Black queer kid, who can see, and whether you're Black or not, every human being can empathize and understand the battle of Jericho and being in the fight of your life. Every human being knows that famous Audre Lorde quote, that if I didn't define myself for myself, I would be crushed into other people's realities for me and eaten alive. And what I'm saying is that we have all been in those places. And I am attempting to say in my compositions that we have to take a different posture and a different perspective if we want more generations and generations to come to get it, understand it, and be connected to it. The stakes have to be higher, and we have to say more about who we really are.
I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, truly, that's it. You know, what is music if it's not for a message? If it's not to feel something, if it's not to connect to the human experience in a greater way. And you're right. You know, I don't have the same lived experiences as you do. However, I can now understand, and there are things I can relate to in your experience. I can relate to the idea of someone else having a reality for me and choosing my own reality. I can absolutely relate to aspects of that music. And if we continue to say, all right, kids, sing the notes on the page.
Right.
You know, I had a beautiful experience over the weekend where I got to watch our Allstate choir perform here in Massachusetts. They were rehearsing, and I had some students that were in it. And my friend, Dr. Jay Saplan from Arizona State University, was conducting them, and they were doing Mendelssohn's High League.
Okay.
Beautiful piece of music. But often maybe high schoolers don't understand the cultural context, and they don't really understand the why behind it. And I watched as Jace explained to them, you know, do you know what the word code switching means? Do you know what it means? You know, this is how I felt in my life. This is how I felt in my culture. And when I code switch between being in front of you or being with my family in Hawaii or whatnot. And, you know, when Mendelssohn was writing this, he had changed his name from being a Jewish name to being a Germanic name in order for his safety, and was code switching for safety. And all of a sudden, giving them that cultural context, that understanding of why we're singing this piece. And you're walking away and seeing students saying, I love the piece Heilig by Mendelssohn. And, you know, it's just different than saying, okay, we're going to sing this piece because it's old and it's a part of the canon and we should. It doesn't mean that we have to get rid of what we're doing. It means we have to frame it differently. And I think that's really, I think you're doing a little bit of both. You're creating new and also framing it really, really differently.
Yeah. And I think by using these genres that traditionally have been kept out of the canon and traditionally have been excluded, right, from the concert stage in choral music, I'm saying that we have to do better and include all of the sounds of America.
100%.
There is no other sound more American than Black music, period. So how can we somehow decide that these are the things that should be done in the concert hall in America? In America, and exclude, you know, all of these other sounds. But it's ironic that when we listen to pieces like Porgy and Bess, or it's ironic when we listen to other pieces that traditionally have been written by white composers that include these same genres, we somehow don't know the Black composers that are the authors of these genres, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that as a young, I still consider myself a young composer, I think that it's so many levels and layers, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that what I'm attempting to do is to say that everything that's wrapped up in here is why the music is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's why it carries such a punch, is because our intentions, right? As you were talking about earlier with the example with the Allstate choir, right? It's what is your intention? You can't know your intention if you don't even know the historical context that the piece was written or birthed out of. Mm-hmm. So we're starting from like this negative standpoint with many singers and musicians, because that's how we've all been taught that this is what matters, the notes on the page and the words, and that's it. And that really is just not enough. And I would argue, honestly, that it never really has been. And I know that's a hard pill for some folks to swallow, but I would argue, and I to this day, every day that I wake up, that our kids and our adults deserve better. We deserve to know how ugly, bad, twisted, messed up the history of the piece is. We deserve to know that truth so that we can not just be edified by that, but so that we can speak that truth to power whenever we have a performance, right?
And we can communicate that to the people in front of us. But that puts the onus on us, those who are doing the teaching, on us, those who are doing the conducting, to not only know that, but to be able to talk about it and to put it forth in a way that is truthful, honest, correct, careful. And I don't mean careful as in not saying the truth, but careful in doing it in a way that is respectful. And that is, especially for those of us that don't come from, obviously, like, I am not Black. So therefore, I need to think very carefully how I present Black music to my students because I do have Black singers. And so
Absolutely.
it's very important for me to do that research and for me to do that work and for me to understand the context and for me to then be able to transfer that information to my students so that they can transfer the music to my audience. Because as I say to them, often, and I think about all the time, when we get to the performance, I am the person with my back to the audience. I am the only one on stage, I would reckon, that is actually not communicating with the audience at all. And at that point, I should barely be communicating to you. I'm communicating to you the bare minimum. You're communicating the truth.
Absolutely, I agree.
Oh, that's it's so beautiful and it's so empowering. And but it does take work. It does take breaking out of the box. It does take thinking and saying, okay, if I'm going to program this piece, how am I going to put it forth? How am I going to introduce it? How am I going to have these conversations regularly throughout my rehearsal process, not just either at the beginning or end? This is this piece. It is this. Blah, 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 blah. And then now we learn the notes and rhythms. And then we get three rehearsals away from the concert. And we say, oh, yeah, don't forget, like, this is what this piece is about. So make sure you put it on your face, too. How does it become an integral part of learning the piece?
And I think that that's all really, really critical. And I think one of the things that you said that I love to talk about, which is that it takes courage. You know, in music, we don't talk about things like courage. We don't talk about what it is to be a demonstration. But I hope that my life and my life's work is a demonstration to other people because we need to see it demonstrated. We can't just talk about it. We can't just say that it's something we should do, need to do, could have done, should have done. But it really is something that we have to do, and we have to see other people doing it. And again, that also gives us the courage. It gives us the strength to continue to oftentimes draw outside the lines. And drawing outside the lines, as far as I'm concerned, is the only way that my people have had a life in America is to be able to draw outside of those lines and continue to push us forward artistically, musically, socially, and I would believe as much as possible, spiritually and emotionally as well, to get us to that honest place is that you have to push it out. You've got to do it. And that you might say everybody might hate it, but it's not, you know, it's as much for you as it is for them. So, yeah.
That's beautiful. And yes, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. We don't talk about courage. I mean, we talk about courage in the way of like, oh, you have stage fright. It's okay. You can let your voice be heard. But we don't really talk about, the courage it takes to perform music that has meaning that takes a lot of heart and a lot of vulnerability to understand and to empathize with. Often I read a lot of Brené Brown and I do a lot of work with, just like that kind of side of my brain. And it just kind of the word vulnerability comes up a lot for me because it takes that. And she talks a lot about how the soft skills or what is considered soft skills, and I have air quotes,
Of course.
are actually the harder skills. It's very easy, I find, that it is pretty easy to teach someone to sing the right notes and rhythms in a piece. It is less easy to stand in front of them and say, this is a lived experience piece, and we need to know the context of it, and we need to be vulnerable, and we need to understand, and we need to revisit, and we need to struggle, and we need to, you know, grapple with this over the next 3 months while we learn this for our concert. That is way more challenging in my mind than make sure that you're singing on that vowel a little differently so it's in tune.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your work in Emancipation, or where people can kind of find you and take a listen? Because I know that I'm definitely going to pop this on and have a good listen as soon as I can.
Yeah, you can reach me at TheAdrianDunn, TheAdriannDunn, on Instagram, as well as on YouTube. We recently just got our Vivo page going. So if you go on YouTube, you put in Adrian Dunn, Emancipation, the entire album, Act One and Act Two, should pop up for you, which some beautiful videos from our PBS special. That were just uploaded in the last like week or so. So please go check those out. Also, I'm really happy to announce a new collection of choral spirituals that will be published through E.C. Shermer Publishing starting in April, with two of my harder spiritual compositions for those of you guys with college or advanced choirs, but also for you guys with high school choirs and you know, really great strong middle school choirs. I think you can take a look at Bells, which is loosely based off of the spiritual rock in Jerusalem, that is dedicated to the life of Tamir Rice. And I Open My Mouth to the Lord, which is dedicated to Eric Garner and George Floyd, which is a pretty tough choral spiritual a cappella, both a cappella. But going back to your point about grappling with the realities that we live with, these are the type of pieces that I hope are not framed in Black History Month, but they're framed in whatever month that you want to do them. You know, they are not concert closers. They are pieces that require us to struggle and to grapple with the realities that our young people face and that we face as adults living in America. Whether we had something to do with it or not, we're all in it together, right? And so I'm hoping that, you know, for all of our choral directors that are out there, that they will check that out. And if there are any orchestral folks out there as well, I have some orchestral arrangements with Rise Orchestra as well that are available on my website, adriandunn.com.
Wonderful. And I will pop all those links in our show notes for today. And I think that's really great. I know I was just looking, I was at ACDA this past couple of weeks, the national, and I was looking at the Oxford just came out with the book of new pieces by Black composers, which is beautiful. Yeah. And now to hear that this new spiritual book is coming out, just like what wonderful things our publishers are doing to help on this cause. And I just think that's great. And I'll definitely check that out myself in not February, because February is over. And that doesn't mean that spirituals are over too. But that's so beautiful. Awesome. Well, just to end our time together here, I have a couple of kind of super fun quick fire questions just to end the episode to learn a little bit more about you. So number one, what is one quirky thing about you?
I like Raisin Bran. I don't know.
That is great. I haven't thought about Raisin Bran in a long time.
I know. It's a thing. It's underrated. It's a thing.
Underrated. Underrated cereal, Raisin Bran. I'll have to check that out at the grocery store again. Forgo my Lucky Charms. All right. Right now, what is one of your favorite choral pieces?
One of my favorite choral pieces, I would have to say, is that Brandon Wattles has an arrangement when the Sooner Will Be Done that is really cool.
I know that one.
Yeah, this was really cool. Shout out to Brandon Wattles Sooner Will Be Done. And also shout out to Marcus Garrett for the Oxford book that just came out, a compilation of Black composers you referenced earlier too. So
Marcus wrote a piece that we used as an excerpt in one of the sessions I was at ACDA, and it just had like the most killing alto line. And I was just like, I walked up to him. I was like, man, like, you want to keep writing alto lines like this, I will sing it so loud any day for you. Like, just beautiful stuff that he is doing as well. All right. What is your favorite hobby outside of music or choir?
Eating. I love to cook, and I am a restaurant connoisseur. And so I love eating out, and I love my favorite chefs around, you know, Chicago as well as Los Angeles. Yeah.
So if somebody visits Chicago, what restaurant should they go to?
Green Street Meats for Texas barbecue. Lena Brava on Restaurant Row in West Loop. If you are into Italian, you gotta go to Formentos on Randolph. It's quite amazing. And if you are into soul food, I would say definitely drop by Ooh Wee It Is or Chicago's Chicken and Waffles.
Chicken and waffles. Delicious. Well, that's good. That's a list for me. I have yet to make it to Chicago, but it is on my list of places I want to visit.
Great city. One of the best cities in America, period, hands down. Anybody who says anything else, fight me. It's okay. Because it just is. And if you haven't gone, you are denying yourself of the best food in America, hands down.
I mean,
and I've been to places in the world. I've been around the world. So I can say, you know, I've been to Boston, New York, Philly, the Carolinas. I've been to Florida, Texas, California, Europe, Africa, you know. Food in Chicago stacks up. It stacks up for sure, for sure. So, yeah, help yourself. Come hang out. It's a great city.
Sounds like I got to bump that up on my list.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's see. Do you have any pets or any kids?
No kids and no pets. Allergic of pets. Ah. And I'm not a fan. Kids, yeah, just my students. They are the only extension of children I have. Yeah.
Same. And I love that. Although I do have two very fuzzy golden retrievers that I love very much that you would probably be very allergic to.
True.
I have a feeling I know where you're going to go with this next one, but you have a choice here. Either number one, one choral tradition we should throw away immediately, or one choral tradition we should keep forever.
One choral tradition we should throw away immediately is having to be quiet during performances.
Yes, I'm so down for this.
One choral tradition we should keep. I really like, so this is going to be a complicated answer, but I like the fact that people stand during the Hallelujah Chorus. Now I have to separate the standing from the piece, but I like the standing during the Hallelujah Chorus. And I think that audiences should be able to stand more in performances. And so when you watch Emancipation, I encourage people to please watch the videos, because you will hear, I don't edit out the audience at all. Mm-hmm. And so you hear the audience, because they're living people watching it. And I feel like you should know that they're there and it shouldn't be an illusion that they're not. So, and again, this is just my aesthetic, but I really feel like people would have a different experience with choral music as well as classical music in general if the environment was different and folks were encouraged to kind of show up how they are.
Yes, I like that a lot. I think we put a lot of gates and boundaries around how to act when we are at a music performance. Yeah. And I think that can really shut some people out, and people can feel like they are living in a culture of, oh, I should know that. You know, one of my biggest pet peeves is when musicians give each other that look when there are audience members that clap in between movements of a piece.
Right.
I'm like,
Right.
they don't know. They liked how it sounded, so they clapped. Why do we have to give this look like, oh, they aren't in the club with us? They don't know. Like, if you're really that intent on having that, take a moment to explain it and explain why. But this culture of, oh, well, they should know that. And aren't they so silly for not knowing that? You know, if we don't get rid of that high level kind of I'm better than thinking, we're going to just continue to push audiences out our door.
Absolutely. Yeah, the politics of exclusion is one that I talk about a lot in classical music. Growing up in a black church, I felt like there wasn't a greater space to learn about inclusivity as it related to who was able to participate, who was able to sing, when you sing, why you sing for different reasons, right? And so I think what I'm so passionate about in my work is making sure that people know, one, why we're singing, and two, why they're there and what they've got to do with it. You know, because just by being in the audience, you are a part of this experience, this music and this art that we are actually making together, whether one realizes it or not. The audience plays such a critical role, in every performance. And so, yeah, those are my two.
I love that. Those are great answers. All right. And so, our final question that we'll end with today, this is a people first approach to singing, and so much of what you're doing is in service and in support of people. So, if someone was if a choral conductor was listening to this podcast and they wanted to be more people first in their approach to their rehearsal or their classroom tomorrow, starting in one small way, what's one small thing they could do or one small thing they could change to be more people first tomorrow?
I think that, you know, you owe it to your singers and to the people who are in front of you to make sure that they understand, and they can only understand the music and the why and what you do if you, as the conductor, understand the why. So that note goes back to the conductor, which is that really constantly assessing in every relationship, whether it is a romantic relationship, whether it's platonic, whether it's a relationship between the director and their choir, you and your students, of every relationship is, why are you here? Why are you doing it? Why this piece? Why did I pick this piece? You know, making sure that your singers understand that you're not treating them like they're beneath them, below you, as much as you are in this space with them, and that you, as the director and conductor, have as much to learn about them, and making sure that they see themselves in the work itself. And if they don't, maybe you have another set of questions to ask.
I think that is a great place to leave it for today. Thank you so much for being on the show, Adrian. It was so great to talk to you and to hear about your work and to be introduced to your work through this medium. And I hope it introduces a lot more people to your work as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a fantastic way to end an episode. Do you know why you're in the room? Do you know why the people who are around you are in the room with you? Have you given them the space to share that why? Have you shared your why? Why are you doing the piece that you chose? And do they see themselves in that piece? And if not, do you have another question to ask? Wow, I am just blown away by that conversation. It was so inspiring to me and so encouraging to me. And I would love to hear your thoughts. Hit me up on Instagram, or on my website, choralconnectivity.com. On Facebook, I have a Facebook page as well. And if you're thinking, man, I've got a really good idea for a guest on this show, hit me up. It's been a busy spring, so I haven't been reaching out to a lot of people. But if you're like, oh, this person, Kirsten needs to connect with this person, that is 100% sure, because they would get along like two peas in a pod. Don't be afraid to reach out. I would love to talk to you and whoever you want to hear on the show. And I am just so excited to be able to keep doing this as my joy and my hobby and meeting new people along the way. So thank you so much for listening. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Choral Connectivity, A People-First Approach to Singing. Again, I'm your host, Kirsten Oberoi, and I would love to connect with you and your story. Find us on Facebook or Instagram or on our website at choralconnectivity.com. If you love the content and feel inspired today, click on the link in the show notes to buy me a coffee to help with production costs, hosting, and possibly to actually buy me a coffee. A special shout out to my student, George Potenza, for allowing me to use his music in this season of the podcast. Thank you for listening. And as always, continue being inspiring, innovative, caring, committed, and passionate about bringing singing to all people.